Hello, just a quick note at the top of this episode that the registration for the 2024 Celtic Students Conference is now open. The 11th annual conference will take place from the 30th of May to the 1st of June 2024, online and on campus in the Université de Bretagne Occidentale in Brest in Brittany. All information is in the show description and details on how to register and attend are there as well. We look forward to seeing you then. Enjoy the episode.
Folge, welcome to the Celtic Students Podcast. Today's episode features Rowan Runge talking about queerness in Celtic studies. Please be aware of discussion of transphobia at around 45 minutes and of transphobic attitudes and politics at around 59 minutes. The precise times for these content warnings are given in the podcast description, where you will also find important links and information mentioned in this episode. We hope you enjoy. Welcome back to the Celtic Students Podcast. My name is Nina Knegert-Guillou, and I use the pronouns she, her. And today I am with Rowan Runge. So welcome to the podcast, Rowan.
Hello, it's very nice to be here on the podcast.
So I think we'll start with maybe letting you introduce yourself, pronouns, what you do for research, where you're based, and yeah, what you're currently up to.
Yeah, my name is Rowan. As Nina said, my pronouns are they, them. I occasionally use Zzier for fun, but mostly they, them will suit. I'm in the very end stages of a PhD, which I've been doing at the University of Cambridge. I've handed in corrections. Hopefully those will be approved soon. In the meantime, I'm based in Glasgow, where I teach a little bit at the University of Glasgow in Celtic and Gaelic. I'm currently teaching on medieval Celtic literature and history, which I'm really enjoying. My research that has formed my PhD is focused on interspecies transformation, by which I mean transformation between human and animal, or in a very few cases between animal and animal, in medieval Irish literature. And while the subjects of my research aren't queer in the sense of sexuality or in terms of gender, my thesis is very influenced by queer and trans theory, in sort of understanding the ways in which figures transform between species. It's also very informed by post-structural theory at large.
That sounds great. Very interesting. We'll get to talk more about this in a little bit, but for now, just maybe to introduce kind of the topic of this podcast, we've come together today and we've talked about this for a while now. So it's great to finally do it to discuss kind of the broad theme of what it's like to be queer in the field of Celtic studies. So maybe first to kind of look back, give some context and maybe define what we understand by queer in Celtic studies, could you maybe give us a little context about queer history and maybe specifically in the field of Celtic studies, if there's any examples that come to mind?
So I guess, in preparing for this podcast, I was thinking about what I would say about what queerness might mean in this context. And I think particularly I was thinking of two sort of, so queerness, maybe in the first instance, is referring to people who would describe themselves as something other than heterosexual and or cisgender, so deviating from sexual or gender social norms. We might talk about LGBTQ plus people, so lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, with that plus, maybe also including intersex people who may or may not identify within this community. So some do, some don't, and also asexual or aromantic people. The plus can go on and on, and it should. For me, queerness is a productive shorthand, but I think it's more than just that. And I'll say what I mean in a moment. I think, foregrounding this, queerness being about sort of this gendered and or sexual identity, way of being, is... especially when we're talking about queer history, we're talking about people who might have felt this way, or do feel this way, or are this way, maybe feel is not quite right, So that's important. So we're thinking about people who are in the field now, who are queer, people who have been in the field in the past, who have been queer. But then there's another sort of dimension, which is that we might talk about queerness in historical documents, whether these are sort of narrative texts or in chronicles or in other sort of various places where some kind of queerness might come to the surface. And again, that might be in terms of sexuality, in terms of gender, in terms of some other way of deviating from a norm. But there's this question that we have when we talk about, especially the word queer, some people, okay, so maybe I should also say some people really do not identify with the word queer who might fall into the LGBTQ plus umbrella because it has been historically used as a slur. And some people find, you know, people have lots of reasons for disidentifying with the word queer, but some people find it to be a painful or offensive. In the spaces I move in, that's typically not the case so much. But I know that that's very based on sort of what communities that you're in. And I think if a person who is not queer is using this, wants to sort of approach using this term, they should do so advisedly and consider how the person they're talking about might identify. Okay, so that's sort of the modern context. But then there's this other dimension, which is how do we talk about queer people in the past? Because a common thing that a queer scholar or scholars of queer studies, not just queer people who are scholars, but people who study this, bump up against is that frequently detractors will say, oh, you can't say queer talking about people in the past. You can't say gay talking about people in the past. You can't say bisexual or transgender talking about people in the past because they wouldn't have described themselves that way. Which is interesting because I think that allows people to make a lot of assumptions about people in the past and essentially assume that everyone in the past was what we would now call straight and cis. And I find that those readings are often not contested with a like, well, how can you assume, you know? But if you try to read queerness, there's this sense of, oh, well, how could you say? Which I think is a reaction that is sometimes it is true that there might be people overreaching for queer readings in text, but also sometimes that is guided not even by someone's personal queer phobia, but by this like ingrained conceptualization of a cis hetero norm in history. Yeah, so there is debate even amongst scholars of queer history about how we can talk about queerness for figures who don't have access to this, didn't have access to this language. My personal thought, and I want to be very clear, this is my personal opinion. This is not the only one. I think our listeners, particularly people who are interested in engaging with this, and maybe our queer listeners in particular, should go away and sort of think about it for themselves. I think this language is helpful because we're the ones writing now. And I'm sure in 20 years, you know, someone will come to our work and say, well, why were they doing it this way? We should do it this way. And I welcome that. That said, I use these terms advisedly, always with the knowledge that gender and sexuality are socially contingent. I think any term about gender and sexuality is socially contingent, and we should be more aware of that. And in considering pe real people who lived in the past, we should first and foremost examine, if we can, how they describe themselves. But we can also think about how we contextualize them for ourselves. In thinking about this, I was thinking about a different podcast that I listen to a lot, which is Bad Gays, which is by Hugh Lemmy and Ben Miller. It's a great gay history podcast where they, you know, talk about gays in history who are bad. And they talk a lot about both the term bad and the term gay, especially given that a lot of their figures. You know, like when is gay the right word? Some of their figures might have been bisexual, some of their figures might have been trans, but why gay? And they're sort of using it as an umbrella term. But in their recent book, which is based on their podcast, they explain this decision to refer to historical figures as gay, by saying, quote, "Our subjects may not have held a gay identity, but their lives can tell us so much about why we do." And so I think there's something in that that I think. Now, obviously, when we're talking about literary studies and we're talking about figures who, if they existed at all, we don't necessarily know much about them. So, not people from the last 200 years who are a bit closer to us, but medieval figures, especially medieval figures who might not have been, so historically attested. I kind of think that, yeah, there's a different way of approaching that when you're not talking about someone that you know existed and whose words you can read on the subject. I know this is going on for a long time, but I sat down and I thought about this and I had a lot to think about it. And I think there's another thing about queerness as a term for me, which is, obviously we absolutely have to ground queerness in queerness as gender and sexuality that deviates from the social norm. But there's also this sort of more expansive definition where this modern sense in terms of sexuality and gender lines up with the other sense of the word, which, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is strange, odd, peculiar, eccentric. This reading that you where we might take our as our starting point, queerness applied in the sort of sense of sexuality and gender, but then also try to read queerly in terms of reading strangely and eccentrically. And actually, this other sense of queerness is the one that I find really useful in my studies. I read this book called Cruising Utopia by Jose Esteban Munoz when I was an undergraduate, and I haven't really recovered from it. And in this book, he sort of says, he's talking about sort of queer art, queer literature. And he says, "Queerness is a structuring and educated mode of desiring that allows us to see and feel beyond the quagmire of the present." Later he says, "Queerness is a longing that propels us onward beyond romances of the negative and toiling in the present. Queerness is that thing that lets us feel that this world is not enough, that indeed something is missing. Often we can glimpse the worlds proposed and promised by queerness in the realm of aesthetic. The aesthetic, especially the queer aesthetic, frequently contains the blueprints and schemata of a forward-dawning futurity." And he says, "Queerness is essentially about the rejection of a here and now and an insistence on potentiality or concrete possibility for another world." And I've always found that so, there's so much in that for me. But again, there's queer scholars who don't find that sense of queerness to be as important and who would reject this. And so I also want to foreground that everything I've said about queerness is part of a plurality of opinions about it. And I encourage people to seek out others. I am not the only authority on the subject.
Thank you so much for all this background. I think it's great to see, to know more about the history, but also to know more about your perspective, someone who's worked on this quite in depth. And so I think maybe moving on from this kind of history of queerness and what queer means to you and to the field of Celtic studies broadly defined. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your experience in the field and if you think that the field today is welcoming for queer scholars, for queer people, and what maybe if you're comfortable talking about what you have felt so far as a young scholar.
I've had a relatively good time. I've been very lucky. I haven't had too many experiences that I found adverse from people in Celtic studies. I haven't really, in I know there, well, I've been very lucky with the people who have taught me in particular and my colleagues in the institutions in which I've been. All of them have been very supportive and kind when my queerness has sort of been obvious, which it is all the time. but I guess I mean that I think, as a trans person, there's a lot of, and so I'm thinking about my, well, so I'm talking about my experience, and my experience is as a trans person who is sort of on the vaguely masculine side of things, although I don't know that I really identify with masculinity, but you know, my queerness is not only in who my, where my romantic attachments are, but also in my gender. And it's a gender that has required a certain amount of admin. And I think I've been thinking a lot about my experience as a student, and that I've been lucky that as a student, I've been very supported by my teachers as I've tried to work through this admin. There was a long time where my name, or not a long, there was a year and a half or so where my name on any official document was not the same as my real name, the one that I use. And I know that my teachers in that period were really good about making sure they never called me by the wrong name, trying to help me point me towards the sort of, you know, especially IT routes that I needed to take to try to change that, and just generally made that relatively easy for me to deal with. You know, my teachers have really made an effort to not, as they should, to not misgender me, because I, the whole time I've been Celtic studies, my pronouns have been they, them. I've been very lucky in that. And then there's another side of it, which is that so not only I as a person am queer, but a lot of my readings are queer. And I've been very lucky that my supervisors, my teachers have all been supportive of my queer readings, both in terms of readings that approach gender and sexuality and readings that are a little bit eccentric, perhaps. I mean, another thing that's really wonderful about my experience so far has been connecting with other queer scholars. I am thinking of our mutual friend and former important person in the Association of Celtic Students. I don't know
Yes.
where he was. Emmett Taylor, who's been just such a wonderful pal and has also been, it, you know, also been someone who I have really enjoyed talking to about constructions of gender in medieval Ireland. And, you know, Emmett's just something, someone I care to name because of their association with Celtic students, and also that they had previously written a post for the Celtic students blog about queerness in medieval Ireland, which I really enjoyed having them sort of put all the sources together in one place. But you know, I'm very lucky to have like this, you know, community of queer young Celtic scholars around me. Not all of whom I want to name because, you know, I don't want to put someone to the spotlight who doesn't want to be, you know, named on a podcast about queer things because obviously for some people that's still a little bit tricky to navigate.
I can only confirm what you said, that I think there's a lot of amazing queer scholars in the field at the moment, and they're all doing great work. And even if we don't name them, we know who they are, and I think a lot of listeners will know who they are. And their work is, and their contribution to the field should be recognized. And actually, in passing, for listeners who may not be aware, in season one of the podcast, Siobhan O'Brien and Eoin McAvoy did an episode in Irish about the LGBTQ community, the Irish speaking LGBTQ community. So, for those of you interested, I think maybe it's another podcast to listen to in relation to this. So I think, yeah, it's great to hear that you've had a positive experience so far, and maybe we can go back in a little bit to discuss a bit more the field. But I think we should at this point talk about your thesis and talk about your research because you've been dipping in and out. So let's just dive right into it. So the title of your thesis that you completed is Transfigurations Coming, an investigation of the depiction of interspecies transformation in medieval Irish literature. This is what the first, one of the first maybe theses in medieval Irish studies that use queer theory and trans theory, I believe. So tell us more. How did you, why did you decide to embark on this project? How did it go?
Yeah, well, I mean, I will say I wouldn't necessarily like to claim that it was the first one that does this, simply because I think anytime a trans person says, I'm the first trans person to do X, Y, and Z, that turns out to be a product of the ways that sort of cis society hides us from each other. Also, I haven't read everybody, like there's
Yeah.
people I know who might have put this in their thesis. So, but certainly amongst it is novel, I think, in that there are, if there are ones that have done it before, there just aren't many. And I think my thesis is, yeah, novel in that way. If it isn't the first, because I'd be happy to be corrected about that. Well, so why did I decide to do this? Well, I think the thing is, I feel that there is quite a lot of kinship between queer and trans readings of texts and these narrative, well, and medieval Irish literature generally. I think some of the ways in which queer readings that began in readings about sort of sexuality and gender read things athwart are productively put into context with medieval Irish material, which sometimes has this tendency to move in a direction that is strange or odd to our modern eyes. And I think for me, one way of approaching that is through queer theory to help me make sense of it. I also think that transformation between species is just inherently pretty, trans in general. I think, and this is maybe not so related to the medieval Irish material, but I think it's not irrelevant that there's so much trans art that I can think of and have really enjoyed that is about sort of transformation between being human and being something else, whether that's an animal or, a sort of cyborg or a sort of supernatural kind of creature or something else. And I think, we as trans people are thinking about the relationship between, I mean, something about transness that I have experienced is thinking at great length about my relationship of my physical body with the social world in which it inhabits, and thinking about how, if my body changes, how will those social worlds change? And I think that is a question that is what these texts about transforming between species are posing us and saying, if someone changes, not in gendered ways, but in species capacities being Eva Hayward's term, how does that change their social world? And yeah, I decided to embark on that because I think it's a way that I saw forward to make sense of these stories of transformation and to try to approach how they work in terms of narrative function. And I think there haven't been sort of, in addition to there having not been, many works of queer theory in medieval Irish studies so far. There's not many. There's also a sort of lack in terms of wide-ranging looks at interspecies transformation in general. There's a couple. I'm thinking of Philip Bernard House's work on canines, which is pretty wide-ranging, but focuses just on dogs and wolves and that. Although indeed Philip Bernard House is one of the people who has written using queer theory and queer approaches of medieval Irish literature as well. So I guess there's a theme. As my thesis hopes to show, but then I think, you know, a lot of earlier work approaching interspecies transformation either really wanted to sort of tie it into why, like, this is much earlier work, tie it into sort of this idea of a pagan Celtic, pagan Irish past, and say, you know, these transformations are a leftover from some religion that existed prior to Christianity, or was trying to tie them in with sort of wider Indo-European folklore trends about, you know, especially like women who turn into birds and stuff like that. And I thought, you know, I find these stories really interesting, and I wanted to get to grips with how they work. Yeah, in terms of depicting the social consequences of transformation between species.
Yeah.
Did that answer
That,
the question that you
yeah,
had?
absolutely. That's fascinating. And I think maybe a follow-up question to that, what texts did you look at, and kind of what characters or figures became kind of the four figures of your thesis?
So, well, when I started my PhD, basically, I went through, there's this massive sort of reference index, like cross-reference index, of all of these themes in medieval and up into early modern Irish literature that are sort of based on sort of the sort of international story numbering system or filing system. And so I just went through that, and every time it mentioned interspecies transformation, I took that, and then sort of edited them a bit for date. Some of them were a bit later than I wanted that wanted. Things like the Children of Lear, that's a bit later than my time frame. So yeah, editing for time, and having looked at all the medieval ones and having a sense of what that looked like, I then sort of started looking at generic categories that I'd be interested in. My chapters are about, so there's one about Dinhenicus Eden, which is sort of a body of texts about the names and histories of place in Ireland, which has a couple of transformation stories in it. I have a chapter on hagiography, so saints' lives, and then I have two chapters on an amorphous, a genre that doesn't have a short name, but is stories about ancient figures from the ancient past, the ancient pre-Christian Irish past, who survive into an early Christian narrative present, in order to tell their stories to typically saints. And those figures are really interesting because you get first person narration about what it's like to be an animal, or the experience, or having been an animal, or that kind of experience. Those four figures really, I think, are ones that I have found really, really interesting. I mean, the other two chapters I also love. And I want to talk about saints in a minute, I suppose. But yeah, these four figures, especially Fintan Mac Bochra, who is a figure who appears in a number of texts across the medieval period, or the and whose story changes as it goes, it seems. But by the very late medieval period, he features in this poem where he's having a conversation with this hawk, the hawk of Achill. The conversation is said to be in Éinbérla, so bird language. Fintan has by this point acquired a narrative in which he survives the biblical flood. He's come to Ireland just in time for it, with Noah's granddaughter who's trying to escape it. She dies, he lives, maybe because he's been turned into a salmon. And then he's a salmon for a bit, and then he becomes a hawk, and then an eagle. And he's talking to a hawk, which I think is so interesting because it's basically, the two of them over the course of this poem basically tell the whole history of Ireland up into their the narrative present in which the poem is set, which is in sort of the 6th century or so. And between the two of them, they know everything. And where someone doesn't know something, the other one does. And so there's this back and forth of history, but it's only possible because Fintan was a salmon and therefore survived the flood. But then also, Fintan was a hawk and therefore can talk to this other bird in her language. So history has to be constructed in this poem through people who turned into animals. And there are some really, I think, I find very beautiful bits of the poem where Fintan is talking about he talks about this worst night of his life where he gets stuck at the falls of Assaroe, because they're frozen and he's a salmon. He tries to jump up them, but he can't because they're frozen. And then a hawk swoops down and eats his eye. The hawk then reveals it was that hawk that ate his eye, and then they bicker. But the descriptions of the falls are very beautiful. And there's this like emotional resonance to, Fintan has experienced Ireland from this very unique viewpoint because he's been a fish, which most people haven't. And similarly, there's this figure called Liban, who is in a text called Eidhas Eochaid mac Mhíreada, so the violent death of Eochu, son of Mhíreada, which is a composite text that was compiled in like the 12th in the 12th century. And the story of Liban within this text is that again there's a flood of what's now Loch Ness, and she survives, but as a human in her sort of house under the lake with her lap dog. And after a little while, she's bored of just sitting in her house under the flooded lake with her lap dog. And she prays to God that she be transformed into a salmon, because she wants to be, she says, sort of happy would be the one who is with the salmon and swimming with them. So there's this like emotional plea to become an animal. And it's this emotion that allows her to transform. And then she turns into like the text is not consistent, but seems to be sort of part salmon, part woman. And her lap dog turns into an otter. And they hang out for 300 years, which is very, very cute. But she is also given, there's a poem that is composed in her voice, which talks about her emotional response to the transformation. And it's also very moving, very beautiful, because again, she's experiencing this aquatic realm in a way that humans don't get to.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Thank you.
And it's nice to hear more again about Liban and Fintan and the hawk.
Yeah. I mean, I think enough of my seminar papers that like you could have guessed what I was going to say, but
Yeah, but I love to, it's just, I think you talk about them in a very evocative way. I think there's something in the way you understand and you can explain the transformations and kind of how they're described and what happens in those texts.
Thank you.
And we'll try and put references in the description of the podcast for anyone who's interested in reading these texts. I'm sure there's stuff online that will be some kind of translation or maybe at least a book that they can find somewhere.
Yeah, well, in terms of the Fintan text, in a blatant act of self-promotion, I have in fact translated the whole thing, which I did in the first year of my PhD, and which I should go back and correct now that I know more. But it's all on the internet, on a website that I'm sure we can link, as a
Absolutely.
hypertext. So you sort of click to go between the stanzas, and you click text that's lit up in different colors in order to find out more information. So hopefully that's an engaging way to meet Fintan.
Yeah, very good. Great. And it's a great poem, so I would encourage anyone listening to go read it.
It's a great one.
So of course you've been doing, I mean, this has been a what, 3.5 year journey for you, this PhD. So what has been your experience kind of presenting at conferences and discussing your research with others in the field of, I guess, medieval Irish studies, but also kind of further fields? Have people been receptive to your research? Has there been any particular difficulties in presenting this research, which, obviously is very novel and presents kind of different ways of looking at literature, which maybe people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, I sometimes find in presenting that, there's this sort of difficult niche that those of us who are working on theory in medieval Irish literature are in, or, maybe medieval Irish and Welsh literature are in, where this theoretical stuff is very new to Celtic studies, hasn't been used very much in the field so far. I mean, I think it's starting to be, but some of it isn't. Which is different from even other medieval literatures, that there's maybe already a stronger tradition in old, well, especially maybe Middle English and medieval French literature of scholars working on not even queer and trans theory, but sort of post-structural theory and feminist theory and critical race theory. Maybe that latter being even newer to that. But if I were to give you a bibliography of sort of the theoretical approaches in medieval literature that I have found useful, most of them would be from, yeah, studies on medieval English, medieval French literature. So it puts me in this strange middle position where I think when I present my material, I wonder if medieval Irish scholars working on medieval Ireland, medieval Wales, medieval Celtic material don't quite know what to say because the theory is so novel. And sometimes I do get a little bit of like disinterest, maybe, or a little bit of pushback because there's this question of, but well, why would you use this theory? Why would you do that? Why is it necessary? And I think it's very necessary. But then there's this other side of it, which is that sometimes I take my, nice medieval Irish literature and I say, well, okay, in the Dinhenicus era, and I say it in front of a group of medievalists from the non-Celtic study side of things, and they are also can't respond because they haven't thought about the Irish literature. They haven't thought about that as a field of study very much. So I sometimes find myself in this bind of, if I go to a Celtic conference, should I play down my theory? And then if I go to a non-Celtic conference, I need to put in so much more material about, well, this is the medieval Irish context that it feels that I'm sort of, doing
In
something very
between.
strange. And then there's this other thing. So sort of on the side of, and I mean, I've had it so, I've been very, as I say, I've been pretty lucky. People haven't really necessarily had a go at me to my face about my theory. But there have been times maybe where I have been advised by someone else or whether, mostly other students or, taken the decision to play down my theory in front of certain audiences in Celtic studies. To sort of say, well, this is a place where maybe the theory will, saying something theoretical will just negate my whole argument. But then maybe there's something more about that I already feel that I have more to prove because, I stand up in front of the scholars and maybe they'll have heard, or maybe I'll have a badge on that says my pronouns are they, them. And then I feel that I have to do more to be taken seriously because I am trans, because my pronouns are they, them. But then on the other hand, some people find my research really exciting. So I think it's really mixed. And I think, I feel that I hope that my research allows both for Celtic scholars to want to pursue more theoretical readings and see the value in them. But then I also hope it allows medieval scholars working on material from non-Celtic areas to think about, yeah, what is going on in Ireland, and yeah, get interested in it, basically.
Well, yeah, as you know, I've used not queer theory but literary theory in my own thesis, and have felt similar Similar things in terms of how it's used. I mean, I think the theory you've been using from what I've seen of your work is just, I think it illuminates this literature in a way that I hadn't seen before, and that's really needed. So,
Thank you. And I appreciate you saying that. And I'm glad it's done what I wanted it to do. But I do think that there's been a little bit of pressure on me to, like, I've worked really, really hard to get my theory into a shape that is that. And I feel that, maybe that I, yeah, that like it has taken a lot of work and certain kinds of work that I maybe wouldn't have to do if I were in a different field. But then, I think that's partly because of the size of Celtic studies. And, I think, in my master's degree, we actually had a seminar on the use of, actually, I think it was queer theory, but in sort of general in literary theory. And we talked about why that hadn't been so big in the field. And the lecturer, who I think this must have been Dr. Siim Innes, who's at the University of Glasgow, talking about, especially in medieval Celtic literature, there's not so many of us, and there's a lot of texts, and so much time has been doing like editions and translation, and even, just first passes of like, what are these texts about? That it really is only now that we've maybe had the chance where we can step back and look at it. So, I don't want to sort of sit here necessarily and say, oh, Celtic studies hates theory because of some inherent like, critical conservatism, but also because we have a lot to do.
It is a fact, unfortunately. Like the it just feels like there's four of us and manuscripts sitting in the library waiting for maybe someone one day to decide that they're worthy to look at. So, but it's great. But you're doing, I think, really important work, and it's bringing it at least to the attention of people to understand that there's different ways of looking at these texts. And so, you mentioned that if you'd been, in another field, you think you'd have had to do maybe less work. Do you think that Celtic studies is less welcoming, as a field for queer people or for queer readings? A little bit for sure, but for queer people, do you think we could be wor more welcoming?
I think that's a tricky question to answer. I mean, the thing is, so for queer readings, maybe for queer people, I think the answer to that is really it depends both on the institution and on the queer person. I have been so happy at, I have felt supported on the whole at all of the institutions that I've been to. I can get, I can, but, there's other institutions that I think I wouldn't, I wouldn't feel that if I went and worked there, if I went and studied there. I guess I'm at the point where it's sort of if I went and worked there, that I would be confident that my potential colleagues would use the right pronouns for me, or, take well to being corrected if I chose to correct them. And so, yeah, this is why I think I say it has to do with individual in terms of their queerness, how it's read. There's some people who are going to have an easier time, and I know that even for myself, I have an easier time as a white trans person who can sort of get mistaken for like a woman, a cis woman, but is never mistaken for a trans woman and is not a trans woman, and can do a certain like as a and that I'm at a point where a certain amount of misgendering is not necessarily gonna like totally knock me out. And all of these things add up to I've had an okay experience. And I think, to be fair, in terms of all in terms of the institutions that I've attended and the teachers that I've had, I don't know that that would have changed if I was a different person, if my queerness presented in a different way. I've had really incredible teachers, and that's not to say that, but I'm saying there's maybe some places that I would be safer that, other people, maybe especially trans women wouldn't be. And I think that is, and or someone who finds it a lot harder to get misgendered than I do at this point, would find it. And yeah, and that's a difficult one. But then there's another layer to this, which is, especially for trans people, it's not necessarily to do with the Celtic department, but with the institution, right? I'm thinking about, yeah, especially things like name changes, needing to take time off for surgery, any kind of support undergoing medical changes, changing gender markers, stuff like that. If the university won't budge on that and the department can't help, well, then what? So there's that too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I've heard the university issue is very much widespread and happens
Yeah.
everywhere. So.
That said, it has happened every so often that I have encountered someone who is in particular transphobic, holds transphobic views. And again, very rarely tells me about that. And that's just gutting. But again, I am lucky in that I can mostly absorb that. What worries me, and especially at this point where, I'm almost on my, like, I'm very nearly done my PhD, like, the corrections are gone. I just need them to be approved. I can cope with that. I've also been out as trans for about 8 years. But I do worry about when people express those views, or I know that people hold those views, and I know that they are teaching students, especially students who are trans women. I really worry about the well-being of those students. And yeah, I find that very concerning.
It is indeed, and you shouldn't have to worry about that because it shouldn't be.
It's not good, but I can say for it.
Well, I'm glad at least that you have that strong skin to protect you, but yeah,
But I shouldn't
thinking
have
of, yeah, and you shouldn't have to, and thinking of everyone else who might not be like that. That's not something they should go through. And have you found in general that students are kind of receptive to queer readings, and that they're more interested in queerness and in and how their own maybe personal experiences actually can inform medieval literature, medieval Irish literature especially?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, I can wholeheartedly say students love this stuff. Students love this stuff so much. Fairly consistently, if I bring up a queer subject in my teaching, or even if I just sort of look like I might, sort of make a gesture without sort of really bringing something up, students are very interested in it. And I have had on at least one, if not more, occasion, a student sort of email me or pull me aside after class to say, "Hey, do you have any more of that queer theory?" Which is just the most joyful thing, frankly, that I can experience. I was so pleased a few years ago. I gave a lecture for first and second year medieval Irish students at Cambridge 2 years ago on gender and hagiography. And after the fact, I was told that this lecture had been mentioned in specific on student evaluations as a favorite, like by name. And then also separately, and so like I didn't have those evaluations, somebody else told me this. But then also several students came up to me and said, "I really like that lecture. I've been thinking about that lecture. It meant a lot to me." And that's not me being like, I'm a great lecturer. I think that's not the point. I think the point is queer people maybe especially queer young people want to see themselves reflected in the world. And so they find this material really, I don't know, like precious. And for me, it's a really precious thing to be able to tell them about it as well. Yeah, and I think they are. I've heard other people have students who are not receptive to it and push back on it, but I think the overall experience that I've heard from other people who are at the sort of who are teaching undergraduates at the minute, especially undergraduates, that if you give them a little, they will ask for more, which is, yeah, really great. And I think an argument for people who maybe don't include that in their teaching material now, thinking about it, because I think it's a way of making students feel much more welcome in the classroom. And
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's been my experience as well. As soon as you mention, you can read medieval Irish literature in a queer way, they're like, oh, really? Which, yeah. I think it's a really joyful thing as well, like as you were saying, contrasting with those transphobic experiences you've had and with the reality of some people just not refusing to see those readings or to understand how that can be done and to have those opinions that, students coming up, students who are interested in medieval Irish and medieval Celtic literature and in Celtic studies in general, that they're excited about this and they'll take over at some point and
Exactly. It's really wonderful. It's really exciting. I'm always so pleased when I can tell this to students and give them the chance to sort of realize that that's out there. Especially for students who have been looking to find some reflection of themselves in this literature, to have a teacher say, your reading of this in this queer way is valuable and is possible. Is just, yeah, really emotionally huge.
No, absolutely. And do you think there's other steps or kind of things that scholars or lecturers or even postdocs and students that they could take to just make the field or their events or their lectures, their programs, their departments? Is there anything do you think that people can make sure they act upon to make spaces more friendly and to make it clear that queer people are welcome, that queer readings are welcome, that these spaces are safe, basically.
I mean, I think this firstly, this in terms of like letting them know that queer readings are welcome. If leaving even if this is not sort of your specialty or something you have deep knowledge about, there's definitely ways you can sort of leave doors open for students to go through on reading lists in terms of, comments and lectures, stuff like that, which I think makes people feel like there's a possibility there. In terms of sort of making people feel more queer friendly. Something that I found out about not even immediately after I came. So I came to do my master's degree in Glasgow and then I went back to Cambridge for a PhD and now I'm back here. But when my understanding is that when I was coming to Glasgow, the department had a little think about it and realized that they had two like single stall bathrooms in their department that were gendered, but they were single stalls, so why? So they sort of thought about it and they were like, this will make everyone happier. And they degendered them. I didn't even know for a little while after I arrived until someone said, oh, we did this. I just thought it was normal. And that made me feel really welcome because it wasn't even just that they did this thing that made my life easier. They also just didn't make a big song and dance about it. Which was really lovely. I think as well, I mean, an awareness of what queer and trans students are going through, especially, relations to in relation to like how their family life might be influenced, sort of medical changes that trans students might be going through, without being invasive. But for example, in terms of myself, I had top surgery about a year and a half ago, and I sort of budgeted myself sort of 2 weeks off, and I wrote to my Well, our supervisor, our former supervisor, isn't that funny?
Oh no, that's so
Isn't it? I
sad.
wrote to Maureen and Winnie, our supervisor, to say, I'm having surgery. I'm going away for 2 weeks. And she was like, "Are you sure that 2 weeks will be enough?" And that sort of support of like, you're making this big life change and you should be supported in it, meant a lot. And just awareness of like how that process of just various aspects of transition might change things for people. I think the option, but not the necessity to share pronouns. So you don't want to put students on the spot, especially students who maybe aren't sure about their pronouns. But if you share your pronouns, it says, even if you think it's self-evident, saying, my pronouns are this, and then not saying you must share your pronouns with me, opens the door for students to share them without making it feel necessary. I recently heard that I think actually ASNAC in Cambridge has let students list pronouns in a document where tutors can see it. So it's private.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. So it's private, so not everybody can go looking, but that's really helpful because sometimes, especially in a teaching system where, yeah, you might need that information, but you might not necessarily, you might have to get it in an informal way. It's nice for students to be able to flag that up so that they don't have to tell every single new person, oh, I've changed my pronouns. Supporting students as they're trying to make those changes to names and pronouns, signposting to IT facilities, stuff like that. And just being encouraging to students as they explore this stuff and trying to signpost them to other scholarship and let them be a bit experimental. That's in terms of queer readings, that's what I have found. Is that are there any other thing? I mean, I think the option, but not the necessity to put your pronouns on a conference badge can help. Making space for queer readings and conferences, being proactive in sort of dealing with queer phobic and transphobic harassment at conferences. Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything that you can think of that I haven't said? What do you do?
No, I think, yeah, I think just making it clear that people are welcome however they are, however they identify, and just don't make it a big deal. Also, just, it's normal. Humans are human, and
Yeah.
we're all sharing these academic thoughts and questions and pushing things forward. So, be happy that other people are doing the work with you
Yeah.
and that they're making you think in a different way as well. I think that's the beauty of academia,
Yeah.
amongst all the other evils of academia, but there's one beauty, I think, that it makes you think and reflect upon what your misconceptions were, what your preconceptions were, and kind of, see text differently.
Yeah.
And not even just through queer readings, through any other reading that people might use. I
Yeah.
think every time I go to conferences and someone brings something new to the table and says, "Well, I've seen this text that
Yeah.
way." But I'm like, oh.
Yeah. And I think that's why sort of having like especially like the possibility that we might have, like especially with a lot of the queer readings that exist of medieval Celtic literature so far, there's like one, right? But we need this plurality. I was so pleased this summer at the ICCS in Utrecht. I was on a panel about it was like gender and theory in medieval Celtic literature. And I gave a paper on trans theory in terms of like maybe a sort of a start to approaching medieval Irish saints with trans theory. And my colleague Robbie McLeod gave a paper about approaching medieval Irish texts with queer theory and especially teaching with queer theory. And so, like, kind of nominally, our papers were kind of similar, but they were also quite different. And I just found it so wonderful to like get to be in a room with Robbie and be like, yes, like we're coming at this in like slightly different ways, but ultimately we want the same thing. Like, how do we do that? And I found that really, really wonderful and joyful.
No, absolutely. If I might just add something for the listeners, especially the Celtic Students Conference is just we We will love and like, please come and do queer readings. Please be queer, be trans, be anything you want. Like, I think we're, yeah, it's really something we want to encourage.
Yeah.
So yeah, if it needs to be said, even though I think for us it may seem obvious, but for people who may not know us, I think, you know, the Celtic Students Conference and the association, we're
Yeah.
there, we're safe if you want to come and join
I think
and
if I
present.
can say one more thing about making things more friendly for students, especially in the UK context, that I mean, this is true in a lot of places where Celtic study is practiced at the minute, but I think I just want to say a particular thing of being really thoughtful about your language and understanding how the political rhetoric around transness might be affecting your trans students, especially your trans women and trans feminine students. There's a lot of really ugly rhetoric that's just like really horrible. And I can see the impact that it has on the trans people, especially the trans women, trans feminine people in my life. And I think just being alive to how devastating that can be is really, really important.
And it's something that needs to be.
Yeah, and pushing and pushing back on that when you find it, if you hear people saying stuff like that, and either pushing back on them about it or just finding ways to assure your students that you don't believe that, I think is really important.
Yeah,
That's what
absolutely.
I'll say.
All right, I think we're maybe reaching the towards the end of our discussion, but maybe just before we kind of finish, is there anything you'd say to people or queer people or anyone who's currently wondering would they want to do an undergrad in something related to Celtic studies or maybe a postgrad degree or even a PhD?
I think go for it. I think, the field needs you. We need you. I think in general, like it is true that the field is pretty friendly. And there's a some really wonderful people who will support you. I think, yeah, and that we need this plurality of voices in thinking about queer studies in medieval Celtic literature. And I think when I've said things that are sort of cautious and worried, I'm hoping to speak to people who are teaching and not just students who are thinking about coming into Celtic studies, because I think for students, you'll find the other people who are interested in this, and you will find the teachers who are interested, and a lot of people I know who I have been taught by are, are so supportive and have supported me quite a lot, and a lot of people I know have also been supported. And I think people will point you the way that you need to go. Yeah, I think Celtic studies is great. This material is the most interesting stuff there is. Why wouldn't you want to pursue
I know.
it?
I of course I agree, having done the same degree as you.
That is so true.
Cool. Okay. I think my last kind of question before we wrap up, and if there's anything else you want to add, but I was wondering if you have any kind of recommendations for people to follow up on. Is there any kind of book or, well, you mentioned a couple books and podcasts earlier that we'll put in the episode description for sure, but is there anything else you would point people towards?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of material out there. My so on the sort of if you're a podcast person and you're listening to this because you're a podcast person, the podcasts that I would recommend are Bad Gays by Hugh Lemmy and Ben Miller, which I mentioned earlier. I also really enjoyed One from the Vaults by Morgan M. Page, which I think she's not updating anymore, but the archive is really good, and it's about trans history specifically. I would recommend, hopefully maybe we can link Emmett's blog post to the Celtic students blog. They talk about the story of the Abbot of Drimna, which is like this wild medieval Irish story about someone who falls asleep on a hill and wakes up, a man who falls asleep on a hill and wakes up as a woman. There's a recent edition of it, which is accessible It's or you know it's a small edition, so it's not very expensive. I don't agree with all of the author's conclusions, but it's a good place to start with it. If you're keen on sort of recent work on trans and queer subjects in medieval literature, the things that I have been recommending, although even these are now a couple years old and new things are happening, which is very exciting, are Trans and Gender Queer Subjects in Medieval Hagiography, edited by Alicia Spencer Hall and Blake Gutt. That came out 2021, I think. It's great. And then there's an issue of Medieval Feminist Forum. It's 55, volume one, issue 55, volume one, edited by Dorothy Kim and M.W. Bykowski. I'm always telling people new to trans studies to read Susan Stryker's My Words to Victor Frankenstein Above the Village of Chamonix, Performing Transgender Rage. That's an article from 1994, and there's been so much work done since then. But that, and then this article by Sandy Stone called The Empire Strikes Back, A Post-Transsexual Manifesto. Those are like my really foundational texts for trans studies, and I recommend them. There's in the medieval Celtic realm, there's a book called Constructing Gender in Medieval Ireland, which is more on the sort of feminist theory side of things, but I think it's an interesting starting place. And then there's a couple of articles as well by Philip Bernard House, who I mentioned before, that do sort of overviews of this stuff. There's one called The Motif of Sex Metamorphosis in Insular Celtic Literatures and Folklore. And then there's one in a volume that was very helpful to me personally called Queering the Non-Human, which is not medieval in any means, but Philip Bernard House has an article in it called The Werewolf is Queer, The Queer is Werewolf, and Queer Werewolves, which sort of starts in medieval Ireland and Wales and then goes on into the modern era and is a lot of fun. So I think that's where I would basically start. But then, you know, I'm a walking reading list on queer and trans theory. So I don't know. Ask me. Ask Nina. Lots of people know about these things and want to tell you.
That's great. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to say on the record?
No, I thank you so much for having me on. It's really great to talk about this, and I hope someone listening, you know, thinks about doing a queer reading, thinks about how they're teaching, thinks about coming and joining us in Celtic studies. Thanks for all the work, Celtic students.
Yeah, well, I just want to say thank you for educating me and educating our listeners. I think it shouldn't be your job, but it's great to hear from your perspective and your research, and it's really important, and I hope that people understand how important this is and how amazing it is and how amazing you are. So thank you.
Thanks, pal. It's been great. It's been so nice to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Celtic Students Podcast. We are a student association that promotes the use and study in and of Irish, Welsh, Scottish Gaelic, Manx, Breton, and Cornish. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Celtic Students, where you will find the latest news in Celtic studies, details of the podcast episodes and blog posts, as well as information regarding our annual conference. We'd be grateful if you could share your feedback with us on your experience of the association, the Celtic Students Conference, the blog, and/or the podcast by filling out the feedback form linked in the description. Slán go fóill!